Yesterday, former IBM executive Bruce Harreld was named the 21st president of the University of Iowa. What's his vision for the future? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg has been covering the selection of the UI's new president. I'll talk with him in just a moment. Then ISU political scientist Stefan Schmidt comments on this week in 2016 presidential politics. Climatologist Elwin Taylor will be along with a weather and crop outlook. And we'll find out why the Gazette Company sold KCRG-TV in eastern Iowa. Your news buzz starts after this news from NPR.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Tens of thousands of westbound migrants in Hungary are taking matters into their own hands after encountering heavy resistance from local authorities in Budapest. As night approaches, men, women, and children are traveling by foot to the Austrian border. There are no signs of any food or medical zone set up along the way. The crowd is instead relying on the goods they have and the goodwill of Hungarian residents who've stopped by with extra water, food, and other supplies. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley is monitoring developments about 20 miles outside Budapest.
Many Hungarians are out here. They've driven their cars out. They're making sandwiches. They've got boxes of apples and bananas and water. They're waiting for the migrants. They say they're ashamed of how their government has been treating these people, and they want to help them. So the government's harsh reaction to these refugees has really spurred a lot of Hungarians to come out and to personally get involved and help these people. They say these people should not be treated like that, and they want to help.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. Meanwhile, thousands more people are still waiting back at Keleti rail station in Budapest, where they have been waiting for days for trains to resume service to countries west. Chants of support later counted by critics outside the Rowan County Clerk's office in Kentucky. That's the site of the latest battle over gay rights. The office is now issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. A deputy clerk is doing that job because the elected county clerk, Kim Davis, is in jail. She's still defying a court order that Davis argues violates her Christian beliefs that homosexuality is a sin. One closely watched economic indicator falls short of expectations today, while another looks better. The U.S. economy created 173,000 new jobs in August, well below the 200,000 that analysts had predicted. But NPR's John Itzty reports the unemployment rate dropped more than expected to 5.1%.
The August report paints a mixed picture of strength in the job market, partly because the job growth number and the unemployment number are generated by different surveys, one of businesses, the other of households. The seemingly uneven result leaves open the question of whether the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates later this month for the first time since before the Great Recession. Those supporting a rate hike argue that historically the August job growth number is revised upward after the initial report by 75,000. That would put August job growth near a quarter of a million. But economists opposing a rate hike say sluggish wage growth and very low inflation show the Fed shouldn't raise rates. John Itzty, NPR News, Washington.
All major market indices are down more than 1%, Dow off nearly 2% or more than 300 points. This is NPR. Chinese authorities will allow public screenings of a movie that centers on gay characters, a first in a nation that practices heavy media censorship. NPR's Bob Mondello has details.
Filmmaker Wang Chao broke the news in a post on Weibo, the Chinese version of Twitter. His film Seek McCartney, about a romance between two men, one Chinese, the other French, had been approved for release in China, he said, calling it a small step for the regulator and a big step for filmmakers. Chinese censors have long been skittish about gay subject matter. They did not permit showings of the Oscar-winning Brokeback Mountain, for instance. And though films with secondary gay characters have occasionally won approval, Seek McCartney's gay leads appear to be a first. The film has not yet announced a release date. Bob Mondello, NPR News, Washington.
More than 14 million people are expected to travel by air during the long Labor Day weekend. That, according to the industry group Airlines for America. Millions more, of course, are expected to travel by rail and car. Patrick DeHaan with GasBuddy.com says the holiday usually brings higher gas prices, but this year, not so much.
Usually we're talking about gas prices being higher during Labor Day weekend due to storms or other factors, the price of oil. For the last at least 5 years, it's been hovering close to $3 or $4 a gallon.
The national average, by the way, is $2.42 for a gallon of regular unleaded gas. Dow is down 310 points at 16,064. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the financial services firm of Raymond James. For over 50 years, offering wealth management, banking, and capital markets expertise with a focus on putting the client's financial well-being first. Learn more at RaymondJames.com.
It's 12:06. I'm Ben Stanton in for Dennis Reese. Partly cloudy skies today. Isolated thunderstorms should remain with us in the western part of the state. Highs in the upper 80s, lower 90s. Tonight, mostly clear. Lows 67 to 74. Tomorrow, isolated storms again possible and warm. Chance of thunderstorms Sunday, and then again on Labor Day, Monday, when it will be cooler. Highs in the upper 70s to lower 80s, and then another chance of thunderstorms on Tuesday. It's Iowa Public Radio.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll have a few quick conversations this hour to wrap up the week. Coming along in just a moment, Iowa State University political scientist Stefan Schmidt will be with us to give us his observations about the very busy political landscape in Iowa and nationwide as we look towards 2016 and the presidential candidates in the running. But first, yesterday afternoon, former IBM executive Bruce Harreld was named the 21st president of the University of Iowa. Joining me to talk about this surprise choice of a finalist who has never held an administrative position at any educational institution, Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg, who has covered the public forums held over the past few days for all of the finalists. Dean Borg, welcome to the program.
Hello, Ben.
This is very interesting. A tumultuous week at the University of Iowa, ending with the announcement of this new University of Iowa president, the most controversial of the bunch. Explain the controversy a little bit.
I joked, Ben, yesterday among some colleagues. I was in Des Moines when I received the news, and I said, after thinking about it for a few seconds, I said, I bet University Hospital's emergency treatment center is jammed with heart pains.
Right. So, the new president, Bruce Harreld, did not shy away from addressing the controversy that followed him this week right from the very start, didn't
That's
he?
Right. He opened that public forum, which then grew very contentious after he spent about 20 minutes or so. Grew very contentious. He opened by acknowledging, tried to disarm what was apparent tension. And he said, I know that you're all wondering, what the hell is this guy doing here?
He did that, too, right after he was announced yesterday as the new president. He told reporters after the Iowa Board of Regents voted unanimously to give him the job, I will be the first to admit that my unusual background requires a lot of help, a lot of coaching. I'm going to turn to a whole lot of people that were highly critical and really tough on me the other day and ask them if they would be great mentors and teachers. And I suspect and hope all of them will.
Well, I think that remains to be seen, Ben. I think that the vast number of University of Iowa administrators and faculty are on board, and they will cooperate and be amenable to being led by a corporate rather than an academic person. But there are some I know, because I predicted, I used the word acrimony, the feeling in that room on Tuesday is not going to be easily changed. I hope that it is, but I don't think so.
We've been covering that on Iowa Public Radio earlier this week, what you call the acrimony in that presentation, that public forum, which took place Tuesday. Let's listen to a couple comments of the now newly named University of Iowa president, Bruce Harreld. This is from Tuesday during his presentation at that public forum. He called the University of Iowa a great institution, but he warned that research and his experience shows that winners can very quickly become losers and that great institutions have an ability to fall very quickly.
The reason is because as they get excellent, they start hardening the things that made him so excellent. They start putting in place processes, standards, policies. They actually hire people like themselves. It's sort of ironic. The better you are, the more likely it is you're going to fail. And the institution is somewhat trapped, maybe big time trapped, because it's hardened. And it starts hiring a lot of people for the past. And they build policies and procedures that were successful for the past.
Okay, very interesting. Hire people like themselves. There's an outsider saying, listen, this is going to be different.
And that's exactly what happened. And that was the reason for the very contentious hostility that you saw in that room. And significantly, I say that, you know, that display of hostility that occurred in the presence of the current interim president, Jan Robillard, who also chaired the search committee that narrowed the field of nearly 50 applicants down to the four finalists and was the one who really brought Bruce Harreld, not the one, but he chaired the committee that brought Bruce Harreld into that public forum. But he did not intervene significantly in that process. You know, I almost saw it like a display of adult bullying, much akin to children on a playground taunting someone who was different from them. And that's what Bruce Harreld was saying in what we just heard. Institutions that are, they set up walls, they harden themselves, and don't go outside people like themselves to make hires.
Let's have another comment recorded on Tuesday of the new University of Iowa president when he was a finalist, Bruce Harreld, a little to his vision for the University of Iowa, if we can end this conversation, Dean, talking a little bit about that. He's acknowledging a pushback by those funding universities about ever-increasing costs to students, tuition costs, and he cited his own feelings about tuition costs for his own children.
I actually used to say that the schools are going to our country clubs with homework because they're adding concierge services and lawn dry cleaning and climbing walls, and it goes on and on and on and on. The intense rivalry and competition for world-class talent at the faculty and student level is one of the biggest forces, I think, driving headwinds at an institution like this. I say all that because I do actually believe there's a way through it. We need to be ambidextrous here. We need to actually dramatically go from great, which we are, institution, to a greater institution in our core. And on the other hand, we also need to do some experimentation for the future and some innovation.
Bruce Harreld speaking on Tuesday, just a couple days before he was named the new University of Iowa president. So a little bit to his vision there, country clubs with homework. There's a phrase that you don't often hear with a new president rolling in.
And it makes you wonder, doesn't it, Ben, what is ahead? What
exactly
is his vision for transforming? Because that he admitted, I mean, I'm a person who transforms corporations, institutions, and makes them relevant in the current world. Now, what's that mean for the University of Iowa? And I think that, you know, there's a message there, and the Board of Regents is seeking ever-increasing rapport with state legislators and the governor to restore what has been more than a decade of decreasing appropriations to the University of Iowa and the three state institutions, beginning during the Democratic administration of Tom Vilsack and Chet Colver. Now, yes, tuition's been frozen, and that's somewhat been reversed in the past couple of years. But during that time, legislators are always demanding more accountability about the efficiencies in state money that they're appropriating to the state universities. And year after year, what they hear is a national publication rating the UI among the nation's leading party schools, less than a half of the student body at the University of Iowa from Iowa, in contrast to Iowa State, about 60% and more than 90% at UNI. So there's and there's also a perceived arrogance by people throughout the state, and that's reflected in the state legislature, perceived arrogance, if you will, by the University of Iowa toward the rest of the state, that they are unlike the rest of us in the state. And that's what regents have been urging Sally Mason to get out and connect with the state. Mm-hmm. And it was significant that you heard the other three finalists also saying, we are getting out and telling the story of the University of Iowa to the rest of the state, and one pledging even that he'd pull a full Grassley.
going to 99 counties. Very quickly before we go, Dean Borg, certainly very much out in the open, this selection process. Comment on this process. With all these public forums, this is certainly there's not a template for a university of this size selecting a president, is there? They do it as they see fit?
That's right. And the Regents this time took great pains to make it an open and transparent, and that's the reason for the public forum. That has not always been the case. And they live-streamed. If you couldn't come to the public forum, it was live-streamed. Many people watched it in their offices and at home, and they were very upfront about what was happening. But there's the faculty at the University of Iowa has a favorite phrase, shared governance. And shared governance does not mean you get to pick the president. It means you might have input into that. But I think there's a misinterpretation and misunderstanding there.
Okay, certainly a memorable start for the 21st president of the University of Iowa, a former IBM executive, Bruce Harreld, being named to that position just yesterday. Dean Borg of Iowa Public Radio, thank you for your coverage and your insights on that. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this being Iowa, and just a few months away from the First in the Nation caucuses, there are candidates in our state, so and all kinds of political news, not only here, but across the nation. Joining us now to share his perspective, Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Hi, Stefan.
Hi.
Well, let's get through a few of these things in the minutes that we have here. Yeah. Donald Trump has signed a Republican National Committee pledge to endorse the eventual GOP nominee in 2016, forego a run as a third-party candidate in the general election. How do you interpret that?
Non-binding, and a lot of people are saying, oh, no, now he's become just another politician. His poll numbers will go down because he's no longer the outside rebel, and he's pledged to vote for president and support one of those other people that he's been vilifying. So a lot of people are saying that they were surprised, but I guess if he thinks he really has a chance at the nomination, you can't, you know, threaten. You can't hold a gun to the Republican Party. And so in some respects, at least, we'll have to see how it plays out.
There was also undoubtedly Republicans who said, you know, because he would not take the pledge to support the eventual candidate, that they were putting that in the negative column for him. So this could be a plus for him as well, couldn't it?
Yeah, but remember, it's a trade-off, right? It could be a plus with the ones who didn't like that, but it could be a minus with the ones who loved the fact that he was essentially the one beating up the other candidates, because a lot of his supporters don't like any of the other 16. And mm-hmm. so this is a very Machiavellian moment, and we'll have to wait and see when the next great poll comes out how his numbers go.
Okay. Yesterday, in the latest round of the dust-up between Donald Trump and Jeb Bush, Trump bashing Jeb Bush not just for his positions on immigration but for speaking Spanish in interviews and on the campaign trail. I'm saying this because I know you're a Spanish speaker, Stefan. This is what Donald Trump said. We're a nation that speaks English, and while we're in this nation, we should speak English. So is this the showdown that will define the GOP race this year? Even though there are 17 Republican candidates, Jeb Bush and Donald Trump now in the center of the ring.
Me parece muy malo lo que dijo Trump. Anyway, I think what Trump said was this nativist thing. You know, I speak Spanish. My parents spoke German at home, so I speak German. I went to a school where we had to learn French. What is wrong with that? You know, we are a very diverse country. A lot of people in this country speak another language at home. When you go out and you go to a grocery store or you go anywhere, you hear other languages spoken, especially Spanish. And eventually, Americans really do learn English because that's the language that's used most commonly. So it was just another one of those things that plays to a certain group of people who are offended by the large numbers of Latinos who are in the United States and who they think are not going to get ever integrated and become real Americans. And it was, odd. I don't remember others saying, although, you know, English as the language of the United States, the official language, is in fact a movement that's still alive, but it hasn't been discussed much. I don't think any of the other candidates have spoken much of it. The other thing that you mentioned is fascinating because obviously if you're Jeb Bush, you're thrilled that Donald Trump is using you as the punching bag, because it means he thinks you're the biggest threat and you're the one who's likely to emerge from this scrum when others drop off and so on. Whether that's true or not is yet to be seen, because I mean, Jeb Bush isn't doing very well in the polls.
Yeah, but look at this. Jeb Bush, should he be so jubilant considering the latest Des Moines Register, Bloomberg Politics, Iowa poll saying that nearly half of likely Iowa Republican caucus goers, 47%, saying it's a good idea to gather up these estimated 11 million immigrants who are in the U.S. illegally and sent them to their home country. So that shows significant backing for Donald Trump's position, doesn't it?
Well, it does. You know, it's in the heat of the moment. I don't know if Donald Trump was the one who sort of lit that fire, or whether people were already feeling that we should deport all these people before, and Donald Trump just came out and said it. It's surprising that others aren't saying, well, look, you know, Ronald Reagan was smart enough to know that this was a losing proposition for the U.S. A lot of the people who are here are, in fact, very hardworking family people. They're much more religious than other Americans. They, you know, most of them are Catholics. And so the values of a lot of the people who are in this country, whether legal or not, from Latin America, their basic values are sometimes much closer to the Republican Party in terms of gay marriage and other issues. And so there isn't a conversation. There's just this yelling back and forth. And the question, of course, is how much do you want your taxes to go up in order to create a mechanism for rounding up and then sending these people back to wherever it is they came from? I mean, everyone says, you know, you think that the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were expensive. Wait till you do this. And how much would it destroy the one thing that the United States has in the world, which is, you know, a country that has always had immigrants, a country that is, in some respects at least, very compassionate, that helps other countries, and that is a democratic society. We do need the goodwill of other countries, and I think the reaction from people, and I've spoken to a couple of people who are friends of mine in Germany and in other European countries, in Italy, they're just saying, what is going on in the United States? You know, you are the country of immigrants. Almost every one of the people who said we should deport all these immigrants, their ancestors came to the United States from somewhere else. And it was probably during a time when there was no immigration policy. If you could get on a boat and come to New York or somewhere and pass the health inspection test, you were in the country. There were no quotas and there were no visas, you know. So it's a very strange moment, I think.
Just a few seconds left. I want to get your comment on this from the Democratic side. Last night, Vice President Joe Biden told an audience in Atlanta, I guess at a synagogue, that when asked if he was going to throw his hat into the race, the honest-to-God answer is, I just don't know. Does that sound like someone to you who might run?
Well, I saw him, and he didn't look very good, to be honest with you. He looked very tired. He looked very stressed. Now I think he probably isn't going to jump in, because he didn't look like someone who was on the upswing to this. He looked like someone who really was burdened by all the tragedies in his family and the difficulty of this decision.
The death of his son, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Stephen Schmidt, always a pleasure to talk with you. I hope we talk again soon. University professor of political science at Iowa State University, Stephen Schmidt. Well, before we go to break, let's talk a little bit about the weather and crops. Very warm start to our September. Joining us now to update us on the weather and the crop outlook, Elwin Taylor, climatologist and agricultural meteorologist and professor at Iowa State University. Elwin, nice to have you back on the program. It feels like summer has started after that cool August that we had.
Summer finally did get here. People were thinking maybe that one warm day that we had was it. But now,
right.
Now it's summer, and go ahead and enjoy it, because we've only got about a week of it. And then after the fronts get through, it looks like we'll be 10 or 12 days on the cool side of usual.
Mm-hmm. Is this still to be explained by El Nino, this warm ocean water in the Pacific, the weather that we've been experiencing?
Well, that's certainly got a big connection with it. We do have a strong flow of warm, moist air coming up from the Gulf that has brought us the possibilities of the rain that we've been having since this warm weather got here, warm and humid. People have said, is it El Nino solely responsible for that. No, El Nino is not solely responsible, but El Nino didn't keep it out by any means. El Nino is responsible for that that's getting into Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm. The past month, very cool, pleasant. I've heard a lot of people say August was actually pleasant in Iowa and wet. How unique was that?
Not real common, but not unique by any means. Happens about once in 10 to 15 years when the temperature of the 48 states are divided on the right down from Idaho to the middle of New Mexico on the Continental Divide. When the Continental Divide divides above normal temperature from below normal temperature, or wet from drier than usual, it usually persists for at least 6 weeks and often for 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the crops. When I'm out driving or bicycling, looking out at the beans and the corn, it looks wonderful. From my vantage point, what does it look like statewide, Elwin?
Almost all locations have ample water now, some excess water from the precipitation that came along with these warm temperatures. And, of course, with that precipitation, the plants have the water they need, and the temperatures will now hurry them to maturity. Some people were worried because of troubles with planting in the spring, late planting and various things, and then the cool temperatures. Will the crop mature? Nobody's worried about that now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, how much time do we have before most of the crops are mature?
We can't tell because of the warm temperatures, but right now they're on schedule.
Okay. Let's look at the fall as it's going to begin here. What can you say about the rest of September into fall weather-wise?
Well, of course, the National Weather Service looks at things like the El Nino. That gives us a pretty good hint of what's going on when we look at the long range, because, well, maybe it's our best tool for long range. El Nino for the Midwest is pretty much our friend. It takes out the extremes. You might say, well, these are extreme temperatures for this time of year, but they're not extremes for summer. And 100 degrees plus is an extreme for summer.
Mm-hmm.
So El Nino kind of takes the extremes out. Sometimes we do have them anyway, but they don't persist for a long time.
Assuming we have reached our top temperature for the summer or the warm months, did we reach 100?
I don't think any place in Iowa has reported 100 this calendar year.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, that sounds unusual, doesn't it?
It is unusual, and maybe I'm wrong, but I'll have to check on that, you know.
Yeah, I don't recall a day going about
when we hit 100 in May a couple of years ago, you know.
Right.
You say, well, maybe I better check a little more carefully before I make a sweeping statement, because I haven't checked everything on that.
Certainly the heat index with the humidity got us up over 100, but the temperature in itself, I don't recall it, but that would be something we could check there. So anything to say about winter precipitation with El Nino in effect?
Well, let's look at the outlook from
sure.
That we consider winter is December, January, February in most people's minds. We expect it to be normal in western Iowa, drier than usual in the Great Lakes, and that switchover coming somewhere around the Illinois-Iowa border. We expect winter to be on the warm side of usual, at least not the cold side, and that because of the El Nino.
Okay. Thank you, Elwin Taylor, climatologist, agriculture meteorologist, and professor at the Iowa State University. Elwin Taylor, thanks for spending time with us.
I wish you the very best and have a great weekend.
You have a great Labor Day weekend as well, Elwin Taylor. We'll take a short break and come back with more of our News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Perhaps you heard that the Gazette Company sold KCRG-TV in eastern Iowa. We'll find out why in just a moment. I'll talk with Chuck Peters. He's the CEO of the Gazette Company. Jonathan Hasid, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University, with some interesting comments on the Chinese economic downturn and how the politics in that country may prevent a recovery. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Thank you.
Support comes from Lansing Funeral and Cremation Services, providing pre-planning options to meet individual needs. Lansing Funeral and Cremation Services, the tradition of our family serving your family, with two locations in Iowa City and Coralville, online at lansingfuneral.com. Support comes from Hancher. Presenting on September 17th and 18th, Lucky Plush Productions performing The Cue, a comedic dance work featuring live music. Information at 800-HANCHER or hancher.uiowa.edu.
He throws a manila folder down on the desk. Across the top is wanted, and underneath a photo of a man and a woman. And he says, do these people live in the apartment next to mine?
This week, your typical guy next door helps the FBI arrest his neighbor, America's most wanted criminal, for real, on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday at 1 p.m., Sunday morning at 10 on Iowa Public Radio News.
It's 12:30, and this is news from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Stanton. One of the nation's largest farm groups is warning of a downturn in the rural economy. Harvest Public Media's Jeremy Bernfeld has more.
Prices for the Midwest top commodities like corn and soybeans have been sliding, and forecasts for farm profits are weak. Roger Johnson is president of the National Farmers Union.
What that means is farmers are going to be facing a lot of financial stress. Loans are going to be in jeopardy. Farmers may not get operating loans. They may not be able to repay all of the operating loans from this year.
Beginning farmers and farmers with lots of debt are particularly vulnerable to a downswing. The Farmers Union wants the Agriculture Department to prepare for an influx of farmers in need of loans and more farmers looking for debt relief. Jeremy Bernfeld, Harvest Public Media.
The former majority leader in the Iowa House is joining the effort to draft Vice President Joe Biden into the presidential race. Iowa Public Radio's Rob Dillard reports.
It was announced today Kevin McCarthy of Des Moines will co-chair the Draft Biden movement in Iowa with Dubuque Democratic activist Terry Hawks Goodman. Signing on to the committee for Draft Biden are current state representatives Jim Lycum, Bruce Hunter, Dennis Calhoun, Mary Gaskell, and Lisa Heddens, and state senators Tony Bisignano and Joe Tsang. In addition, the campaign has hired two political operatives to direct the effort. Biden has been considering a run for president and said yesterday he would not hesitate if his family could handle it. I'm Rob Dillard, Iowa Public Radio News.
Although he says it probably won't make a difference, Iowa 1st District Congressman Rod Blum says he'll vote against the Iran nuclear agreement when it comes up for a vote in the U.S. House. He says he finds many parts of the deal troubling.
I thought the point of the agreement was to prevent Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, period. I don't think our country or the Middle East will be safer when Iran has a nuclear weapon. So my job is to keep America safe and also, to the extent possible, protect our allies.
At this point, it appears that President Obama has secured the votes needed to keep the agreement intact. Blum spoke to a crowd today that was on Thursday at a sports bar near the UNI campus in Cedar Falls. It's 12:33. Presidential candidate Bernie Sanders says his growing popularity among Democratic voters is a result of their disgust with the campaign finance system and corporate greed. The Vermont senator says one of the ways his campaign is different from others is that he's one of the few candidates without the backing of a super PAC.
We have, up to this point, received over 400,000 individual contributions. And you know what the average is? $31.20. How's that? So we're not going into these meetings with billionaires and coming out with millions of dollars.
Sanders also said he would not nominate anyone for the U.S. Supreme Court that would not want to overturn Citizens United. That was a 2010 ruling allowing corporations and unions to support or denounce individual candidates. A new federal report estimates as many as 8,000 Iowans have what's referred to as ASD, or Autism Spectrum Disorder. The report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the prevalence may now be one in every 68 children. Liz DelSandro is a clinical professor in the University of Iowa's Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders and says she specializes in the treatment of children without the disorder. And she specializes in the treatment of children with that disorder. DeSandra says that ASD is not always obvious, but it can be identified.
It really characterizes itself as,
challenges in communication skills, challenges in socially interacting with others, and then also what is termed repetitive behaviors.
Children with autism may play with their toys differently, she says. Instead of using their imaginations like other kids, they may line toys up. But before a child is diagnosed with ASD, several professionals, including psychologists, educators, and speech-language pathologists, have to be involved in watching and assessing the child. The first television ad backing Republican Governor Scott Walker's presidential campaign to begin airing in Iowa next week highlights the 2011 battle with public sector unions. The 60-second ad was released Thursday by the unintimidated Super PAC that has announced it is spending $17 million in the next 6 months on an ad campaign backing Walker. That's news from Iowa Public Radio at 12:35.
Support comes from Luther College, where campus visits can include talking with professors, coaches, and conductors, staying in residence halls, joining music rehearsals, and more. On the web at luther.edu.
Support comes from First Presbyterian Church, Iowa City, inviting the community to help celebrate 175 years, September 11th through 13th, Friday dance at Old Brick, a Sunday hymn festival finale, and more. Details at firstpresiowacity.org.
A lot of things have changed in Iowa over the past 100 years.
Country schools have closed. There's a lot less work for blacksmiths. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa Week begins September 7th on Talk of Iowa and River to River.
All week long, we'll be exploring Iowa then and now, the changes and the challenges.
Talk of Iowa and River to River, weekdays on Iowa Public Radio.
And we're back with more of this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come in just a moment, we'll find out why the Gazette Company sold KCRG-TV in eastern Iowa. The Gazette Company has had that from the very beginning of that TV station since 1953, this week announcing the sale of that. We'll find out why from the CEO of the Gazette Company in just a few moments. But first, Iowa State University animal science and veterinary researchers have made possible the first ever successful bovine embryo transfer in the small southeastern European Republic of Kosovo. Kurt Youngs is joining us, professor of animal science at Iowa State University. Hi, Kurt.
Hello. How are you, Ben?
I'm fine. I'm not up on my bovine embryo transfers, so you're going to have to explain to me what that is and its significance.
Okay. Well, firstly, a fertilized egg is what we call an embryo. And as that embryo grows and develops, we have the ability to basically wash the female's reproductive tract to recover this embryo prior to the time that it will implant or attach to the uterus. And what we try to do by using embryo transfer is to identify animals which have superior genetic qualities, such as very high levels of milk production in the case of a dairy cow.
Mm-hmm.
And by recovering embryos from these females and transferring them to other females who don't have the same high genetic potential for milk production, it's a way to develop a herd of cattle with a much higher level of milk production than would be possible if we just let all the cows, you know, breed on their own.
Mm-hmm. So they're going to have more milk production because of the work of Iowa State University and having the genes from the cows here.
Yes. My colleagues, Dr. Jim West and Mariana Yonke, we work together as a team and identifying some heifers at our Iowa State University dairy farm, and we recovered embryos from these animals based upon their high genetic potential for milk production. We collected the embryos, went through a washing procedure to be sure that they were very safe and there were no potential pathogens that could transmit disease, and these embryos were frozen, shipped over to Kosovo in what we call a dry shipper tank. That we put liquid nitrogen in it at minus 320 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, even colder than a typical Iowa winter. And by putting them in this dry shipper tank at these cold temperatures, it keeps the embryos deep frozen. And then when we're ready to take the embryo, we can thaw it and transfer it into a surrogate or a recipient female. And again, allowing a cow, in this case from Kosovo, that didn't have very high genetic potential for milk production, to give birth to an animal that came here from Iowa but has tremendous possibilities of greatly improving the milk production over there in Kosovo.
And, of course, that's not just a one-time thing. That's a lineage that is starting.
Absolutely. So the first calf happened to be a male that was born, and the private farm Yurilona where this calf was born was actually quite excited because he knows that they can collect semen from that bull and be able to do artificial insemination and really very rapidly propagate this superior genetics for milk production. But we have several other pregnancies ongoing, and as these animals are born, some will be male, some will be female, and of course the females we will go ahead and breed with some high genetic quality semen for milk production and allow them to really more rapidly make genetic improvement through the importation of these embryos from Iowa State University than they would have done otherwise.
Kurt, tell us a little bit about the impact this will have for the people of Kosovo, considering their dairy needs.
Well, one of the challenges that Kosovo as a fairly young and developing nation faces is that their agricultural production system is not as well developed as what we have here in the United States. And so we've been trying to work with the folks there to take some of their best and brightest faculty members and veterinarians to teach them modern agricultural production technologies. What we hope to do is to, by making a significant change in their dairy cattle industry, we hope to double or perhaps even triple the amount of milk that they are producing within country, which is going to make the milk available to the consumers at a lower cost. It's also going to keep the money in Kosovo rather than sending it outside the country's borders and having to buy milk and import it. And right now, I believe they import something like 80% of the milk consumed by the citizens of Kosovo comes from outside the country.
Mm-hmm. So this is a very good move also in terms of, we have just a few seconds left, but in terms of diplomacy, isn't it? Better relations between our countries.
Absolutely. And the people in Kosovo are of Albanian heritage, and they've had a long allegiance to Americans going back to President Woodrow Wilson days, but more importantly, with a NATO-led action in the late 1990s to stop the ethnic cleansing that was going on. And the people of Kosovo are so grateful for Iowan's help and the Iowa Sister States program. What we're trying to do now is take what used to be a military relationship and put it into the private sector. And Iowa State College of Agriculture and Life Sciences and College of Veterinary Medicine, we're just proud to be able to play a role in helping others improve their lives.
Fascinating. Kurt Youngs, how Iowa State University is involved in improving dairy production in the southeastern European Republic of Kosovo. Kurt Youngs, thank you very much for the conversation.
It's my pleasure, Ben. Have a great day.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The Gazette Company has owned KCRG-TV since its founding in 1953. Until this week, the Gazette announced it has sold the local ABC affiliate for Eastern Iowa to a Georgia television company, Gray Television, Inc., for $100 million. Chuck Peters joins me now, CEO of the Gazette Company. Hi, Chuck.
Hello, Ben.
Why was KCRG sold?
Well, that's not a simple answer. Let me just give you a little context. The Gazette Company became 100% owned by a trust for the benefit of the employees almost 3 years ago. And the trust exists for the purpose of growing value through growing businesses and growing people. And so to pursue that mission, we were on an acquisition strategy, actually, looking for other people to join our shared ESOP enterprise. So that's what I was working on when, in February, I got a cold call from Gray Television, and they said that they had their own strategy and that they wanted KCRG to be part of their effort. And I said no, because we had just done this ESOP transaction, and we'd done it with the purpose of maintaining continuity, independence, and focusing on the community. And two is I didn't think, as a fiduciary of the trust, that I could agree to a transaction that would result in the payment of significant taxes that would decrease the value of the trust. And three, there's this kind of a wild card of a spectrum auction for broadcasters, which is really a wild card, and so how would you put a value on the station? And they came back and said, well, with respect to the last one, we can handle that. We can just handle that by contract. With respect to the continuity and the independence and the focus on community, why don't you meet our family? Because while they are a New York Stock Exchange traded company, they are controlled by a family that is really controlled by three women, a mother and two daughters. And come and meet the family, come and meet our management team. And when I met them, I realized the power of 3,000 people who are totally focused on broadcast. And when I started to imagine, how could I deny the people of KCRG the opportunity to be part of this powerful network that could experiment with new technologies, figure out where the world was going with mobile, had a Washington, D.C. bureau, had the ability for dozens of news directors and dozens of sales managers and all these people to network together to really try to figure out where is local broadcast going and what's the best path to get there. But then I said, but how can I be a good fiduciary financially? And so we really worked on potential transactions, and we just couldn't make anything work. And finally I said, just tell us the top price you could pay us in a cash offer. And they came on August 18th and proposed $100 million. And that was so much more than the TV station had been valued in the trust that really, doing my fiduciary duty, I couldn't say no. Mm-hmm. When you have the opportunity for the employees to be part of this much more powerful network and to the benefit of all the employees financially, I felt I had to say yes. It's astounding that it went from an expression of interest on the 18th to money in the bank on September 1st.
Interesting.
That's unheard of in this industry.
KCRG-TV is the market is Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, Waterloo, and Dubuque. What can viewers in this market expect as far as changes?
I think they should expect almost no changes. Gray, as they said, did not buy us because they wanted to change things. They bought us because they loved what we were doing and wanted to continue our commitment to our philosophy. I would expect, and I think they'll post a job here pretty soon, that there will be a general manager hired, but there will be both internal candidates to us and other internal candidates to Gray, and they'll select a great general manager. But other than that, you shouldn't see much change in the news side or promotion or sales or anything that goes on in running a television station.
What about for the Gazette? What does this mean for the newspaper and the online news service? The two entities continuing to serve, to share resources, a building, for instance?
Right. Well, we did sell, we don't really know the answer to that question, because this transaction happened so quickly that we're going to start the conversations on how we, operate going forward next week. But as you saw in the official release from Gray, they want to continue the partnership with the Gazette resources. We have an issue in that the Gazette newsroom is in one building, with KCRG, and the sales organizations in another building together. And I think just generally people like to have, the entities all in the same building, so we've got to sort that out.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, will there be layoffs either at the TV station or at the Gazette company?
None are anticipated due to this transaction.
Okay. You talked about the transformation, the necessary move here to pursue a different vision for the Gazette company. Give us an idea of what you're looking at in the future to do with this considerable amount of money, $100 million now.
Well, we have been talking for months, and we continue to talk with other businesses, as we say, in the greater Chicagoland region. So Chicago to Milwaukee, Madison, Twin Cities, Omaha, Lincoln, Kansas City, St. Louis, back around again. Companies that are owned by someone who's 65 or 70 years old, they have a nice operating company, they don't have a transition plan, they don't want to sell to a competitor, they don't want to sell to a venture capitalist, they like the idea of ESOP, but they don't want the administrative headaches of ESOP. And so we say, come and join our shared ESOP enterprise, We are a tremendous company that believes in growing businesses through growing people and focusing on learning, adaptation, engagement. And we will handle the fairly onerous administrative burdens of being an ESOP with you.
Okay. Chuck Peters, thank you very much for this explanation. CEO of the Gazette Company, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
Your News Buzz continues here on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer on this edition of River to River Friday Conversations, short conversations to wrap up the week to get to some news we didn't otherwise cover during our talk shows. As we've been hearing today, economic news that the U.S. employment growth slowed in August, but the unemployment rate fell more than expected to 5.1% in August. That's from 5.3% in July. In the past few weeks, big economic news has been out of China. China's economic slowdown causing some real ripples across the global economy, including here in the United States. Let's turn now for some analysis on China's recovery from Jonathan Hasid. He's assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University, and he studies Chinese news media and symbolic political messaging. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello.
Well, when you see what the Chinese economy is experiencing in terms of economics and how they make decisions politically, what do you see?
I think we're in for a long period of stagnation. You know, I don't think China is going to be able to achieve the kind of growth rates that they have for the past 30 years. I think that signs are clear that the export-oriented heavy investment model is reaching its natural end, and you know, it remains to be seen if the Chinese Communist Party, the ruling group in China, will be able to transition the economy to something more appropriate for their sort of current income level, current level of influence.
Mm-hmm. And since China makes these decisions differently and in a more cloaked fashion, certainly than we do here in the West and in the United States, what are you looking at when you look at the politics of Chinese economics? How can you tell what's going on? What signs are you watching?
One sort of important measure that people like to look at is the measure of consumer spending, how much consumer spending is driving the economy versus, say, exports or other factors. And in China, it's very low. The share of consumer spending in China is around 35% of GDP, which is quite low. And for comparison, in the United States, it's about 70%. And so what this means is that relative to their income level, Chinese consumers are essentially buying less and saving more. And we might think that savings is a great thing, but essentially the savings rate in China, the household savings rate, is too high for a number of reasons. And so this is money that's being kept out of the economy in lots of ways. And when it is invested, it's often invested unproductively. The Communist Party is aware of this, and President Xi Jinping of China has been, and his economic planners have been trying to push China toward a more consumer-oriented model, but so far with quite limited success.
Mm-hmm. So the products we get from China that China is producing is going to, for instance, us here in the West, and not very many to the Chinese themselves.
Exactly right. Especially, you know, China is now the second largest economy in the world, and so we would expect that Chinese domestic consumption would be a larger driver of the Chinese economy than it is, and certainly than the government would like it to be.
So what type of fork in the road, if that's the good image there, does this present for the Chinese leadership?
Well, the Chinese leadership can, I mean, certainly in the, I don't want to discount the ability of the Chinese economic planners. I mean, certainly the past 30 years have shown us that there's some very capable people running the Chinese economy at the top. But the problem is that to encourage this kind of consumer spending in China, the government needs to, for instance, beef up the social safety net. There need to be major reforms in the banking sectors and among large state-owned enterprises, which are very influential. And it's hard to imagine that the government will be able to rein these things in effectively, given the kind of political will it's going to take and given everything else that's going on in the Chinese economy.
When we compare, say, the United States and what we as U.S. citizens get from our government in terms of services, how does that compare with Chinese citizens?
It's substantially more limited. The government, central government and local governments have been investing heavily in infrastructure, so that's nice. I mean, certainly places need roads and airports and that kind of thing. But in terms of providing a reasonable health care system in terms of providing old age pensions or some kind of retirement system. That's all quite inadequate. There is a very, very minimal guaranteed income for the very poorest in China, but it's a pretty low number. And so for a lot of families who might be facing, say, retirement, they might be facing a medical emergency, they might even want to buy property, they're going to have to save for a tremendously long time to do that. And that savings is not, you know, it's essentially kept out of buying consumer goods and propping up domestic consumption.
Also, in this week's news out of China, earlier this week, China put on that huge military parade to mark 70 years since Japan's defeat at the end of World War II. According to analysts, sending some mixed signals about its military and strategic aims, the big parade of tanks, missiles, the columns of soldiers through the streets of Beijing. I wonder, since you look at Chinese news media and symbolic political messaging, what are your thoughts on that and how that was received by the rest of the world?
Well, you know, the rest of the world, I think, took it as a positive signal when President Xi announced that the Chinese military, the army, was going to decline by 300,000 personnel. That was seen as sort of an olive branch to the world. But I think that's a bit of a misreading of the situation. There's been talk at high levels in the Chinese government about reducing the size of the army for a long time. And it doesn't mean that military spending is going to decline. Instead, I think what it means is that the Navy and the Air Force, the two branches of the Chinese military that are actually more likely to be involved in a confrontation, are going to be getting increasingly large share of the domestic military budget. So the idea that this cut of 300,000 army troops is somehow a signal to peace, I think, is probably not accurate.
Okay, Jonathan Hasid, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thanks for your time, Jonathan.
Thank you.
All that's left to do on this News Buzz edition of River to River is to send you into this Labor Day weekend with a reminder that you can attend an Iowa Public Radio Studio One music event this afternoon at 2 o'clock in the Iowa City area. Java Blend, which I host, will present a live performance by award-winning Iowa singer-songwriter Chad Elliott. No tickets needed. Just show up at the Java House in downtown Iowa City this afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. Of course, in a few weeks' time, that performance will be broadcast statewide on Iowa Public Radio's Studio One. Let's go out with this song from Chad Elliott's new album. It's called Matters of the Broken Heart. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Ben Stanton helped us out today. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. Have a wonderful Labor Day weekend.
Bartender, pour me another round. I'll be at the end of the bar, sad and lonesome, searching for the sound. Do some for anyone who's ever been torn apart. This is not another drinking song, this one's for the broken heart. 'Cause I love ended in the typical fashion. I was trying to keep my cool. She was looking for a little more warmth, a little more passion. I guess you could say it was all just a matter of time. If I had my way, I'd do the same the second time. If I had not loved her, if I had not cared, if I hadn't thrown caution to the wind, the sweet memory might not be there. The blood that runs through me runs colder since we've been.